You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! Ryan and Amy Green's son, Joel, was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive form of cancer just after his first birthday. During Joel's fight with cancer, Ryan had an idea to make a video game about the experience. Ryan made one scene of the video game and began taking it to video game expos to gain interest in a complete version. At this point, Joel was still alive, so it wasn't very clear what the end of the video game would be. During this time, it became apparent that there was significant interest in the game, and Ryan and Amy decided to use their savings to fund the creation of an entire game. In the time the game was being made, Joel beat the odds for a time, but eventually another tumor resurfaced and Joel's cancer was declared terminal, and he eventually did die from the disease. Joel and Amy finished the game, which turned out to be an amazing memorial to their beloved son. Ryan and Amy, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you. We're glad to join you.
You know, I heard your story first, probably where a lot of people did, on Reply All and Radiolab. I wonder if you were surprised at the huge amount of interest that people had in your project and that they were so willing to, you know, put you on such a large platform.
Yeah, I'd say at least for me, it was definitely very surprising. There's so many people that are doing really creative, amazing, personal things in video games. And so I know when Ryan first went to the Game Developers Conference, I was just a little nervous for him because I knew that he was really hoping that something would come of that experience. But I knew that everyone who went was hoping, you know, that someone would like their game or that they'd have a conversation about funding or that, you know, they'd be able to move forward in a big way. And so I was surprised when he came home from that conference and told me about all the journalists he showed the game to and the people that were interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's strange feeling like kind of knowing the human interest angle in all of this, you know, like it feels like something where people write about it because like, oh, that sounds like an interesting story or that's kind of unusual. And so like I was, you know, grateful for that, but then also just kind of astonished that they kept writing about it and they kept talking about it, because it just feels like something that should, you know, that would go in a news cycle and then it would be, you know, people would stop paying attention, you know. And I think that's how we are in our culture with tragedy, that we see something sad and we look at it and then we kind of move on. And so I think it's been both a surprise but also a blessing that like people have stayed interested and they've stayed listening to us. And I feel like, you know, as parents, like you just long for people to listen. And I think that that's the hard thing about childhood cancer is that, you know, this experience changes you like completely. And, you know, I think for many other families, there's just this sense that, oh, like the sickness is gone and people have moved on, but you're still left in the wreckage afterwards, in the aftermath. So yeah, it's just kind of this strange thing of like, you know, wanting to say something and wanting to be able to listen and being very grateful that people listen, but then people move on. And I think I see, you know, kind of that struggle of like childhood cancer awareness and things like that, and just wanting people to continue to care and wanting it to continue to change them and in the same way that it's changed us, you know?
I mean, I can attest to that kind of relentless interest that you're talking about. When I was in preparing for the interview, I was trying to research something about it and just Googling the name of the game, which I don't think I said in the intro, is called That Dragon, Cancer. Just Googling that name, there are pages and pages of write-ups about this and about your story. Mm-hmm. You know, like I mentioned, it being on Radiolab and Reply All, there was a prominent piece in Wired magazine about it. And so, you know, I kind of expected those things to come up. But again, there were pages and pages, and part of them were people reviewing the game, of course. but they're also telling your story too. I mean, it's kind of, it's just amazing kind of how it's caught fire.
Yeah. I think in that regard, we kind of like feel like it's created kind of a wake beyond it, because I think in that regard, like most people haven't played the game. They haven't even seen the game, and what their experience with it is they've read something about our story. And so in that regard, it kind of became less of like about the game and more about the maybe cultural thing it represents.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting to realize that, you know, maybe, you know, by creating this game, we might be able to share Joel's story with, you know, maybe 100,000 people over the life of the game. But then we realized that we were actually able to share Joel's story with millions of people because of the documentary and the various articles and the podcasts and the just all the different media that's been created around it. And then that's been exciting because we really tried to show what it's like to love Joel and to love God and to wrestle with tragedy. And I think we've been, frankly, pretty amazed that people were excited to listen to that kind of story.
I think it's just a realization that, like, what they really care about is our testimony and the way we talk about it and the way we share it. And I think that that can take so many different forms. So it's really not about the game. It's just about maybe our willingness to share our story and our experience and our hopes and our doubts, you know, like being willing to share what I feel like is failure in some ways.
Well, and I think, too, it was wild knowing we'd had as much press coverage as we had. When we went to release the game, there was just a real feeling of apprehension, wondering if it could possibly live up to the hype kind of that surrounded it. Because, of course, we knew journalists would care about a story like this, but we also wanted it to be able to stand on its own and be a rewarding experience.
Yeah.
Hey, that's so interesting, that and something I hadn't really thought about. I mean, I guess there was a real chance before the game came out for people to think these are really, really sweet people who don't know how to make a good video game.
We had someone who reviewed our game, and in their review of it, that was a podcast review, they said, "We had already decided that if it was a terrible game, we just wouldn't ever review it. We'd never say anything, but we really liked the game and it was good. And so we're glad we're able to review it." And I do think people maybe felt that way at the beginning, that like, because here's a family that's pouring their heart into this video game for their son, and if it's awful, let's just maybe say nothing. But instead, I think we really appreciated that when reviews came out, people really gave it, I think, fair reviews. They talked about the game's shortcomings and its strengths, and yeah. And that in a way was a real compliment to us, that they weren't afraid to give us some critique in the game as well.
So one of the things that I think about often is that how there are so few good examples of Christians in media. We tend to have like our Joel Osteens, and sometimes like that's the best it gets. like we have the really horrible examples, and then we kind of have a lot of examples that just seem to be somewhat shallow. And I wonder if that was part of your, is something you thought through when you were sharing your story and you're not ambiguous about your being Jesus followers.
Yeah. Like extreme Jesus followers, like the weird kinds. yeah. I mean, obviously we think about that. I mean, I think what you're describing, honestly, it's something in the realm of taste. And I feel like there haven't been much in Christian art or Christian media that appeals to maybe our shared taste. Because I think for the audiences that they reach, they're very effective. They're very affirming. They're very encouraging. Because that's what they're meant to be. And I think that maybe what we're describing is like the stuff that's being created is being created for a certain audience, and that audience really likes it. But an audience like us, it just doesn't appeal to us. And I think I share some frustration in that, in realizing like there's not Christian media for me, you know, and the kind of things that I ingest and the things that I find interesting and compelling kind of, you know, search and explore the human condition and the messiness of all of that, you know? And so, but at the same time, like there's very much that like, evangelical in me, right, that just doesn't want to like display a negative story, you know, like I wanted to wrap it up in a bow, as authentic as we could be. I was hoping for the thing that we could point to and say, no, see, like if you do this, then, and if you pray right, if you hold on to the end, if you, you know, have just this mustard of faith, even if there's a lot of doubt, then God will do this. And I think in that regard, like choosing to do that in public was terrifying, and also something that we're just like, is this a good thing that we've done? Is this a good thing that we've pointed the cameras at us in essence and said, watch what God is going to do? And then God didn't respond the way that we expected. And we did that in public, which I think makes for really compelling art, but I don't know if it's good, you know? And that's been kind of maybe some of the struggle over the past few years.
Well, and I think we were really self-conscious initially going into the medium of video games as Christians. And I know we really tried in early interviews and things to be pretty forthright about our faith, because we didn't want anyone to buy our game and play our game and then feel like it was sort of a bait and switch where they thought that they were getting one thing and then they were surprised because, oh, this is a Christian game. But at the same time, we didn't think we were creating a Christian game. Like, we were creating a game for people, and it told our own story, and our own story was a story of faith. And I think we were amazed how much people were really willing to let us share our story, and that there was this big difference as people viewed it between preaching and just sharing your own story and your own heart. There were certainly moments in the game that I think both of us thought were maybe a little too explicit and a little too heavy-handed. And so it was funny when we'd get reviews that would say, it's not preachy at all. And like, on the one hand, it was sort of a relief, like, oh, good, it's not too preachy. And then on the other hand, you'd kind of be like, it wasn't preachy at all. Like,
like this didn't affect you
at all. Did we do at least a little bit?
Maybe we should have been a little more preachy.
Yeah,
so I just think there's that line. I know that there's Christians who think that you can't really have explicitly Christian art that's good art. And I don't know, I think we tried.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about it is, like, I think I know from playing the game the parts that you were worried about. And I also understand why someone would say it's not preachy at all, because I think the main reason is because it is just real. That I got the opinion, I got the feeling that these are real things that you said to each other, and you're allowing the world to kind of, you know, peek behind the curtain into a private place for a second that that was real to you.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's real and it's not real at the same time. It's like, it's almost like a stylized version of us. And so, I mean, I think there's even a little bit of safety in that, is that like, I can reveal to you maybe some of these weaknesses, but maybe they're the weaknesses that I want to reveal to you. And so it's just like always this push to be like, oh, maybe I need to be more transparent, or I need to like include these doubts. And it's always this, like, this feeling of like, I want to be transparent, but what is too transparent? You know, like, what is too transparent to be discouraging, or what is too transparent to be false? Because like, everything is so mixed up, you know? And I think one example is just like our depiction of Amy's faith being steadfast and mine being floundering. And it's like, I think even mine flounders, yes, but like, even by the end I was on board too, you know? And so I think there's just like this, I know it's hard, because it's like, we're trying to communicate something. We're trying to communicate our story, but we're also trying to like communicate how we think about things and what we wrestle with. And so it's kind of this, it's the strange mix of documentary and creative nonfiction. And
I think throughout Joel's illness, I really felt like one of the things I learned during those years was that faith didn't mean you had to be perfect, and having faith didn't mean you couldn't have any doubts. And I really felt in my spirit that God knew I was human, and that he was okay with my humanness, and he was okay with my doubts, and that I didn't need to worry that my doubts would somehow be bigger than my faith or God's ability to answer our prayers, you know? And so that was something we really wanted to include and that mattered to us. But then it was weird after Joel died, realizing that we always wanted to be transparent. We always wanted to show, you know, our our wrestle with doubt in the middle of faith. And then you realize that now the context everyone has for the game is that Joel died, and the context we lived it within were years of wild miracles and unbelievable surprises with Joel. And so I think that was a tricky thing for us as we put our faith in the game, was knowing that people had the context of the end, where we, when we were living it, did not have the context of the end of the story. And so I think our life was probably more hopeful than we could convey in the middle of the game.
So if it's okay, I want to talk about kind of the mechanics of the game for a little bit.
Sure.
You know, Ryan, you worked in software, but you really hadn't had much of a background in games before you started this. Is that right?
Actually, I worked for a few years for a small indie game company. We made some mobile games, and they're like tower defense games. And, you know, I'd also spent many years doing like video production and editing and stuff like that. So, like, Amy and I came with quite a few years of just like theatrical and film and, or, you know, video production and some game production going into this.
But this was certainly the first kind of full-length console or like a PC game.
Something we would like fund.
You had made some apps before, right?
Funding for.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd made some games before, but they weren't nearly the scale of it.
So, you know, I'm here in Austin, Texas, which is a big tech town. And I'm at the age where a lot of my friends work in tech somehow, somewhere, but I never have. So their language is just completely foreign to me. So when you're creating this game, like what's in front of the screen in front of you? Is this like code or is there a graphic? How does it work?
When I'm making the game?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's a mix of things. Like, I did a lot of the sculpt, like the modeling on the game. And so that's like when you sculpt the sets, like the, so like for instance, we made a park and with like a park equipment, and like there's a duck and some bread and a bench. And like, I would like sculpt those things. And then another person on our team would like put the lighting in, and then we'd like, you know, kind of dress the set. And then we'd bring that into our game development tool, and then we'd like string together actions on top of those environments. So like, I could say, okay, I want the camera to follow the duck, and now when I press the left key, I want it to turn left, and right key, I want it to turn right, and then when I press, you know, when I click the button, I want it to swim to that point. And so like, so, you know, the creation of the art is just like a small part of it, because then you have to attach those actions, and those actions are just like scripts. Those are just things that you type out, like commands that you type out. So to answer your question, a lot of time is spent just in like the guts of it. Just kind of like, if you were to look at it closely, you wouldn't know that it was a game about cancer or if it was a first person shooter. Because a lot of the time is spent in kind of the minutia of it.
You know, I think it's probably a good time to explain to those listening that the term game, when we use the word game, is pretty loosely as it applies to that dragon cancer. And I think some have called it a non-game game.
Sure. A lot of people have a trouble with the term game. I mean, we use it as shorthand for video game.
Sure.
And like, I see video game as like a medium. It's like the interactive medium. And so when I say game, a lot of times people get really like have a physical negative reaction to that word. Because they're like, well, no, cancer is not a game. Or they think of it as like, well, how can you do something so like base as make a video game for something so serious? And I think the realize, you know, it's not the, it doesn't come with the realization that like, that's how we interact with our children. We play with them, you know, and that's not like a less than interaction with them. That's like our primary form of communication with our children. And so if I said, you know, like, would you like to, you know, play with Joel? Would you like to meet Joel? That would be a different context, but it would still be a video game.
And I guess for me, at least, when they started this project, I wasn't really very aware that there were all the different genres of video games that there are. Like, I thought of video games like something I'd play on my phone or something my kids would play on a console on the TV. And I didn't realize that there were serious games and there were games that were mostly text-based. And there's games that deal with people's personal stories. And just there, like I always say, my husband loves these slow-paced art house indie movies that I think are boring. And I didn't know there were games like that. And like, it was something as we created it that I thought, I don't know if I would even like our game, but I know my husband and his friends would totally like our game. And so just kind of realizing that, that just like in film, there's all kinds of genres of film. In games, there's all these genres too that people might not be aware of.
Well, you know, the reason I bring that up is because, you know, there'll be plenty of people who are listening to this who are gamers. But there'll also be plenty, you know, I'm mostly on the show, mostly interview authors of who write Christian spirituality books or theology books. So maybe that demographic, they're not naturally always gamers. Right. But as I played it, the thing I was thinking was, one, there is a lot of lived theology in this game. And the learning curve is not such that a middle-aged to elderly person, maybe with a little help, would be able to experience this game. And yeah. I think experience is the right word. Because, you know, it's a series of vignettes. And essentially, you need to use your directional buttons on your keyboard and a space bar or a mouse. It's not complicated, I think, is what I'm trying to say. And so for those who may, like, the last time they remember video games, it was like Super Mario Brothers, or, you know, they're vaguely familiar with like a Call of Duty game because they see commercials on TV. Like, I really want to encourage people to give it a try, because the content is so good and so important, and it's something so completely different. And also, as an aside, the price is about what they would pay for a book of theology or Christian spirituality too. So when I played the game, and I should say, I haven't really played video games since I was like a sophomore in college, and that would have been a PlayStation 2. And so I was a little apprehensive, like, am I going to be able to do this? Amy, when you and I first emailed and you said, we'll send you this Steam code, and I was like, cool, and immediately had to Google Steam code to figure out what that was about. Until I played it cool in the email, but had no idea.
Sure. That's me most of the time with the game dev team, because okay, they're all in this world. And I'm just like, I write things and I'll help you.
You know, it was such an intimate experience. I think that's the word I want to use. I feel like now, I feel like I've spent some time like babysitting Joel for you and spending a little time with you as well. You know, I kind of feel like you're old friends just from playing that game. You know, I was thinking about, and you mentioned the animation part, and it's not super, the animation is not super detailed. You know, Joel's face is blank. To me, there's part of that that's obvious. You know, it's not like a first-person shooter where graphics are really important.
Right.
Or where, you know, precision is important. And I wonder, it feels like that decision was probably very purposeful, just the style of the animation, enough to make people feel human, but not so much to distract from the story.
Right. Yeah, no, that was very intentional. I mean, I think choosing a very distinct art style has a few benefits. And one of those is that it's focused more on expression and like impressionism. So like, I would find it more similar to like impressionism or expressionism, where the environment kind of alludes to the mood of the piece. And the characters are blocked in enough that you know who they are, but you're filling in the expressions, you're feeling in the emotions. And in many ways, like a lot of the narrative of That Dragon Cancer is more similar to like a radio drama. where you're hearing the environmental sounds, you're hearing our conversations, but the character animation is kind of set as a series of tableaus. You know, they're in a pose, and you're not seeing their full expressions. You're not seeing the full body language. You're just getting a hint at it. And we found that it was enough, because really what we could do is we could provide clips from our home videos, like audio from our home videos, and we could record scenes that kind of sounded like that and just kind of put you in this space. I mean, that's the thing that about the video game medium that I feel like is unique to every other medium, is that you feel the sense of presence. Like you said, you said, I felt like I babysat Joel for a while and I was an old friend. And that really makes me happy, because I want you to feel like a friend. I want you to accept this invitation to like walk with us for a moment and grieve with us and feel with us, because, you know, we find, I mean, that's what we're called to do as believers, right? Like we're called to share in pain and share in comfort. And I think, you know, rather than being able to offer kind of like saccharine, like solutions to all of our pain, like rather than like a moving to try to take away pain, we're acknowledging pain. We're sitting in the pain. And I think by doing that, like, I think people can share in that, you know, like they understand that feeling. They understand loss. They understand sorrow. And so that makes it just like infinitely more relatable, you know?
And I think we realized that we were telling Joel's story, and his was the only story that we could really tell in a personal and raw and transparent way. But we also knew that his story represented so many other people's stories that, I mean, everyone has a Joel in their life somewhere, whether that's a grandparent or a parent or a cousin or your friend's kid. Like somewhere along the line, you know someone that's really suffered in their life. And it felt like by leaving the characters' faces blank, perhaps people could put a little more of themselves into the story.
Part of that intimacy that I talked about comes from the dialogue. And some of it is, you know, you mentioned from your home movies, there are voice messages from Amy. I should say, and both of you played yourselves in the voice acting here. Also, part of it was internal dialogue that we got to hear. One of the pivotal scenes in the game is when you're basically getting the news that the cancer is terminal. There's someone who I'm guessing is some kind of like hospice worker who's, you know, saying we're very good at end of life care. And at that point we get to hear, Ryan, your thoughts, your internal monologue. And one of the things that you said that I thought was so fascinating was, in the movie, I would be doing this, you know, like I would be yelling. And I feel like that really must have been at least very, very similar to what you were thinking. And wondering if you were, it's such a strange thing we do as humans, but wondering if you're reacting how you should be reacting in a certain situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think even when we were having these discussions with the doctors over the years that we were fighting this illness with Joel, there'd always be this kind of like detachment, like this like, oh, like the first time they ever told us that Joel was, you know, ill, like the doctor came through the doors into the lobby and then led us to the hallway and then led us into that little room. And like, you know, what's going to happen because you've seen the movie. And so for me, as being somebody that's been so inundated with media my whole life, you know, like I kind of felt like we were living out this movie, and like, and wondering, you know, so like my thoughts and my internal monologue were always different, you know, than what's being said. And wondering like, and talking so practically about such terrible things, became the normal. And so I think it's the thing that maybe, people don't realize unless they've gone through something like that. Like you kind of always imagine how you're going to react and how you're going to deal with it. But then when you're actually in the midst of it, you've never kind of imagined it with the grace that you'll receive in the middle of it. And so, you know, a lot of times that grace could be in coping, that grace could be in dark humor, that, you know, that grace could be in detachment, you know, like those are different coping things, but also like things don't feel the way that you expect them to.
Well, and sometimes that grace was just peace that you never expected to have. It was something I learned really early on is that, with everything that was going on with Joel, our whole world had to stop when he was diagnosed with cancer. We moved into a hospital for 3 weeks. Some friends took our other kids. We saw them when we could, but just life became very much just about Joel. And there was plenty you could worry about. And you could think to yourself, how are we going to manage to live our life and have my husband work and get cancer treatments? And how is this, you know, there was just, you could infinitely worry, but I realized that like I had grace for today. And that what I worried about tomorrow, I didn't have tomorrow's grace yet. So those worries felt insurmountable, but tomorrow would come and then there'd be grace that day also. And so I just learned that worrying about the next day and the next day and the next day didn't ever, it wasn't ever useful or helpful because each day new grace would come and it would be sufficient for that day.
And any time that like we would tend to flail, like I'm the personality that I would like flail. Like Amy would be steadfast. She'd be like, let's just wait. Let's just wait for the update. We don't have to try to make all these decisions. And I would use like my best debating and apologetics, like arguments for like why we have to make these rash decisions. And so often, like had I just rested, had I just stopped flailing, you know, had my posture been different, you know, then I would have not caused so much undue harm. And so I think that was just like kind of part of the process. You know, our pastor gave us advice like very early on that stuck with us. And it was like, you're going to get a lot of news and all that news is going to be changing constantly. And so that roller coaster, you know, like don't get swept up on that roller coaster. And I think that was one thing that allowed us to kind of stay grounded throughout the whole process was always kind of returning to like, this is the news now, but it will change. And it certainly did for us for many years.
So much of the game is just very honest and transparent wrestling with God and what he is doing through all this. There's a point where, Amy, you're talking about the temptation to, or the going in between proclaiming good things and proclaiming healing versus just waiting it out. That seems to, like, I think that that had to come from a real place. You know, I think so often as Christians, we're like, we want to believe in God's power and believe in healing. And then at the back of our minds, I think we're so tempted to think that whatever is going to happen is going to happen regardless of whether we pray or not.
Yeah, I think that before Joel got sick, I saw that as like two very different camps of Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, there were the Christians that believed, I mean, and I suspect that as people, we kind of do separate into those camps, that there's the people who believe that like God will wait for us to have faith or to move or to partner with him. And what we do infinitely matters in terms of what God will do. And then there's the people who believe that like God will do what he wants to do, whether or not we are obedient. And as I walked many years as Joel's mom while he was sick, I think that just started to feel like just one long continuum that sometimes God says, I want to partner with you to do this. Let's do it together. And sometimes God says, I'm taking care of this and you can just wait on me. And I think it's just hard because I think as people, we want to say that we kind of stand one place or the other. And I, for many years, wanted to stand on one side of that and say the other side was wrong. But as we walked through faith and saw the miracles we saw and then saw the disappointment we saw, I think we realized that God's just so much bigger than our categorization of him. That certainly has come a lot as I've grieved Joel and as I've mourned. There are so many things I just don't understand. But I think I'm just realizing more and more that I'm not necessarily meant to understand all of God. I can't. And so there comes a place of just trusting him and trusting that he's good and trusting that he loves us. And that trust means you don't necessarily, I still question everything, but I'm okay that my questions don't have answers because trust can be the answer when there's not a specific answer. I think when Joel was sick, I look back at things I wrote in my blog for him, and I'm surprised how much faith we had, how much, like, when things would get really hard, there was almost an excitement that would rise up because you thought, oh, now God has to do something. I wonder what he's going to do next. It's going to be wild. And I look back now and it just feels strange that I ever thought that way and felt that way. Like, it's hard to really understand that that was me, even in the midst of everything. I think because our disappointment now colors so much of our reflections of that time.
Yeah. I was going to add to that. I mean, I think there is that, you know, I don't know, Calvinist versus Arminian kind of free will versus sovereignty sort of thing going on. But then there's also, like, to me, there's the revealed names of God, and like God reveals himself as like Father and, you know, King and Lord and like all these different terms that I have this picture in my mind of what that looks like. And certainly through the lens of my own fatherhood, I'm like, how can you call yourself Father and let Joel die, you know? And then, like, I see in Scripture that, yeah, well, like, he sent Jesus to die. So, like, what did I think I was going to escape, you know, suffering? And so it's like this, it's this weird thing that, like, even God chose to suffer. And that's just so bizarre to me. That like I don't feel like I can hold anything. It feels like I can't hold anything, but I have to hold everything. Like in that tension of like, I just don't understand. You say this, but this is not my experience. And so I think in that regard, like my theology has become like of God has become bigger, you know, like, and that I'm embracing the mystery more, which is terribly frustrating because like I want the certainty that theology gives me. And the problem is that we had our theology and then the theology didn't match our experience. And so then you could say, well, your theology failed or you didn't do enough, you know? And so it's just like, well, yes, I can accept maybe I didn't do enough, but maybe that's not really the point. And I think just like all of that wrestling has been, you know, something that we tried to just kind of lay into the game you know, I think I was so inspired for so long by the story of Elijah and the audacity of somebody to like build an altar and call down fire. And I think in many ways, like he kind of tried to do that. And I don't know if that was a good or bad thing. And like, I don't think you know, you're not supposed to put God to the test, but then Elijah called down fire in front of a bunch of prophets. So like, which one is it? And it's like, I think like struggling with those pictures that I see in Scripture and laying those out today and wrestling with that, is tough, you know? And then looking at the state of the world and realizing like the state of the world, there's death everywhere all the time. And why hasn't God stopped death? You know, like if you overcome it, why isn't it done yet? So like, and so I think that there could be so much theology that people could correct me on and I'm willing to listen to it. But at the same time, like I'm realizing like we followed this theology that was supposed to be worked out and it didn't work. So now what? And I think that that's the tough thing about like, of just, you know, like wanting to have that surety and not having that surety that I thought I was going to have.
Do you, I mean, if you could go back to yourselves before Joel passed and you had all this hope, would you tell yourself to do something different? Or do you just feel like, no, we did it how it was supposed to be done?
That's maybe been my biggest wrestle with God. Like when Joel died and we had believed he'd be healed, even like as he was dying, I thought, you know what, this will be it. Like it'll be that very last moment and he'll be healed. And even when he died, I thought maybe he'll raise from the dead. Like God had just done so many amazing things. And as I would pray for him to be healed, I would feel in my spirit that instead I should just pray about his destiny and his future and his calling. And to me, that felt really settled that like, oh, God's got his healing. I can just pray for his life. So when he died, I was really surprised. And then I was angry because I thought of all the times that I felt like God led me to have faith for him. And I kind of like asked God, like, why wouldn't you have told me, like, why wouldn't you have prepared me if your plan all along was for him to die? Why wouldn't you have prepared me for that? Why wouldn't you have told me to stop having faith, to stop having hope, to make my peace with it? I never felt those things. I always felt like we were supposed to just keep having faith and standing strong. And I feel like, I guess, like that was a big wrestle for me. But what eventually happened is I just started to think through these questions and I realize, like, well, what would I have done if God had told me to stop? Yeah. Like, if God had said, I'm taking Joel, just trust me, stop having faith and just be okay with this. I think I would have thought of all the times in the Bible where someone changed God's mind and I would have kept trying. You know, I would have thought, oh, well, that's you now, but I'll keep petitioning like you say. And I realized, like, if I'd done that or if I hadn't, either way, I'd be at his funeral and wondering if I had done enough. If God had said, it's okay, make your peace with this, and I did, I think I'd be at the funeral disappointed with myself, wondering, should I have prayed more? Should I have asked God more? Should I have had more faith anyway? And so I realized, like, wow, like, if I'm disappointed with God, I know God can handle my disappointment. He's big enough for that. But if I'm disappointed with me, I don't know if I can hold up under the weight of my own disappointment in myself. So it was hard because on the one hand, I felt almost like God had betrayed me, like he'd led me to believe something that wasn't true. And that felt so out of character for God and so against what I believed to be true of God. But then I thought of the alternative of God telling me how this would go and saying, like, it's okay, just love him. Like, just love him and trust me that heaven's good. And I realized, like, I don't think I could have done that.
So it's almost, it was a form of grace.
It was. And it's weird to think about. Like, I always get a little, like, there's things in the Bible that trip me up. Like, is it Rahab with the red thread that she puts out the window? And then later the soldiers come looking for the spies and she lies. And, like, God blesses her in her lying. And I'm like, that's not God. Like, I've read The Hiding Place. And, like, you don't have to lie. And God will bless you for not lying. And, you know,
Corrie Ten Boom says otherwise.
Yeah. So there's just, like, these weird things where you go, gosh, I don't know. Like, part of me wants to say, like, God, you can't be good and have told me to have faith for something that you weren't going to, like, answer my faith the way I expected on. And then the other part of me looks at the situation and says, hopelessness is not good. And
certainly
I've started to
been good for you.
Yeah, and I've started to think a lot about how God says, you know, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. And, like, okay, love I get and faith I get, but hope, like, part of me wants to say hope doesn't belong in there. Like, hope's useless. Like, what good is hope? But, like, I think I've just kind of wrestled with it enough to say God sees value in hope, and it's a value that I don't necessarily always see, but I have to trust that if over and over again in the Bible he says that hope is important, then hope is important.
It's like hope is not necessarily attached to a specific promise.
I don't know. I've studied and studied it, and when I study it, hope just always is translated a lot like faith. So that I'm like, oh, I want there to be, like, a distinguishing thing there. And I want this revelation that can kind of put a lot of this to rest in my heart. And I haven't found it yet. So, yeah, I don't know.
You know, so my wife is a hospice chaplain here in Austin. And she will regularly come across people, family members who believe that their loved one is going to be healed, you know, in the ninth hour. Now, often that relative is like 93 years old, and you're like, really?
Right. Like, when is heaven just good?
Yeah. And so, you know, something that she has told people is that you can believe in God and his promises, and you can have hope for healing, and then you can also prepare yourself for that not to happen. And mm-hmm. I wonder if that rings true to you at all.
I didn't feel like it was necessary
to prepare for,
to prepare myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like what would that have gained us? I mean, I think Amy's father at one point said, like, don't borrow. What does he say?
He said, let's not borrow trouble.
Let's not borrow trouble. Hmm. And so, like, that pre-mourning, you know, like, I think more than anything, pre-mourning sets your posture. And, like, if our posture would have been in mourning beforehand, like, I'm not sure we would have behaved the same way. And I think in that regard, like, when I look at the final months of Joel's life, like, we're in California, we're going to Disneyland, we're going to the Redwoods, like, we're going on walks, and we're having our adventure, even when Joel is declining and we're going through trial treatments and, like, and I look back and I'm like, wow, like, he was so far gone for so long and I didn't realize it. But, like, in those, but what I could see in in his expression and in his demeanor was that he was enjoying himself. And like, he was having fun and he was having joy and he was playing with his brothers and we were having our adventures. And like, I wouldn't have changed that. And so like, I can mourn afterwards. There's time to mourn afterwards. Why do I have to mourn before? And so I think that whole preparing ourselves is almost the sense that like, if I can avoid some level of pain, I'm going to try to do that. Hmm. And I guess I'm of the opinion that like, pain proves my love. And so it's like, the more it hurts, the more I'm just like, yeah, I desperately loved him. So like, bring it, you know, like I'm going to go as deep as I can right now. And it's going to hurt. But like, why would I try to escape that pain? That wouldn't help either. And so I think that there's just this, I think a lot of times, maybe in our modern Christianity, we spend a lot of time like trying to avoid death, you know, like spiritual death and all that stuff, sacrifice and all those different things. And like realizing that maybe we're robbing ourselves, like, because we're called to die. Like, that's the thing we sign up for, is dying to ourselves and dying because love, you know, like can hurt, you know, and that we mourn deeply and that we grieve deeply. And if we steal ourselves away, if we try to mitigate that, then I don't know.
And I think our situation with Joel was a little different probably because, yeah, when we were first told that he was terminal, it was a few months before he was going to turn 2, and they weren't sure that he would make it to his second birthday.
That's what I was going to say is, you had an external reason to hope because, yeah, God had done these amazing things, and Joel had lived, yeah, so much longer than he was supposed to at that point.
Yes. Right. We had at least 3 different times where they told us like, okay, I can't explain the years you've had up till now, but this is really it. Like, you really need to get ready. He's dying. And so 3 different times he didn't die. He responded to a treatment he shouldn't respond to, and he got better, and we had 6, 7, 8 more good months. And I think I can look back and say, like, by living like he would live, we really enjoyed those years. But I mean, think if we lived them the whole time thinking that he would die, we couldn't have enjoyed those years in the same way, I guess. And I don't know. It's tricky because, I mean, certainly when he died, I thought, like, even his birth had actually been this really traumatic thing where it was sort of miraculous that he survived his birth. And then he survived 3 different times when they thought tumors were going to kill him. And so part of me when he died was just like, I don't get it. God, why save his life 4 times and then let him die? Like, you know, there were just these big questions. But yeah, I think I wanted to be like the best mom I could be to him, like as a mom in loving him, but also spiritually. I wanted to, it was an honor to extend ourselves in faith for him. And I wouldn't want to look back and have regrets about that. And that's one thing, like, despite all my questions, despite my disappointment, like, despite the fact that, like, I have a whole wrestle with God now that I work through, I love that I don't have any regrets when it comes to how we loved Joel and what we expected for him. Yeah.
You know, Ryan, one of the things I was thinking about, I think it was in the Wired article, where you were at an expo after Joel had died. People were, obviously, they were doing the demo, were very, you know, emotional. And in the article said something like that you weren't particularly sad at that moment. And I thought, it's got to be so strange because that is the way life is. People who have horrible tragedies in their life, they can be happy after that.
Yeah.
How strange it must be for both of you promoting this game, doing interviews like this, when you might be having a good day, and how strange it must be to one console people who have just gone through this journey, and but to have to kind of drudge up these feelings again.
Yeah, it's weird. It's almost like being a public person, like like you become a persona, like, oh, grieving father and grieving mother. And like, this is how we're allowed to dress. And this is how we're allowed to act in public. This is a lot what we're allowed to joke about. And, you know, like, I'm hyper aware of all of that. And it's tiring. I don't know how I'm allowed to act, and I don't know what I'm allowed to do or what I'm allowed to work on next or what we're allowed, you know? And so, and it's because like we hold people in public spectacle, like to different standards, you know, and we like project on them a lot. And so if they're laughing before an interview and then get somber, like, oh, you know, well then it must be false.
Yeah. They're a fake person.
Yeah. They're fake. They must not care. And I'm just like, I'm just so hyper aware of that. So for me, I think it's just caused me to have a different type of grace for people like that. And for people kind of that have put themselves in the public eye. And but at the same time, like, there's this sense that like, I ask people to come along with us and like, they're experiencing it for the first time. And so it's like, I can be a comfort to them. Like I can, by being willing to talk about it. Like, this was the weirdest thing. I mean, throughout the whole experience is that like, I would share our story through this game or through an interview. And then the very first thing people want to do is share their most, like the hardest thing that they ever went through.
Sure.
And like that exchange of intimacy and like hugs and everything and tears with like strangers was just unbelievable. But I was like grateful for it because it's like when we give ourselves permission to talk about the things that change us and we do that in public, we give permission to a whole bunch of other people to do that too. And like, I realized that like, there would be people that said like, we're at a gaming expo. I lost my mother 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I lost my nephew last weekend. Like, I've gone through, you know, I'm going through this now. And like, where else do they get to talk about it? Like, how often do we like talk about these really hard things that we're going through, or do we just have to kind of put on a happy face, you know? So, so in that regard, I'm just like grateful for the opportunity to do that. And it's a joy to do that. And it's an honor to do that. But certainly like the persona that I feel I have to project makes me wary, you know?
But I also think that I think that's true for anyone who's lost someone close to them also. Like, like I think ours is a very specific and sort of strange version of that, trying to figure out how, you know, to be when someone has just experienced your loss for the first time through the film or through the game. But just in regular life, like I'll run into a friend we haven't seen in a while and they'll say, how are you? And I'm already calculating like, oh, what do they mean? Do they mean like, how am I today? Because today I'm good. Or they haven't seen me since Joel died. Do they mean like, how am I like universally? And
right.
Like all of this kind of rolls through my head and I'm trying to figure out what response I'm supposed to have for them, which is a very strange feeling to have when you're figuring out what is the response they need from me. But I think everyone who's grieving has a little bit of that, trying to kind of navigate, you know, like if you're grieving too long or too much, people don't like that. But if you're not grieving enough, then they go to your friends and say, are they really okay? You know, like there's it's tricky, maybe because we don't talk about it enough with each other.
Yeah, I think we just tend to the oversharing degree, whereas most people don't overshare like we do. So
I think that's a better alternative than being alone, though.
Yeah.
I think it must be such a, like, to all of that stuff that anyone who lose a young child for any reason would go through, to add this layer on top of all that, which is you know put your savings on the line to make this game, and then it's got to be, I mean, on this level, it's a really good thing that it is seeing success right now.
Well, no, I mean, I think it is good. I think the point being that like, as I was saying earlier, like as Christians are kind of like, we're called to die. And I think that that's even been like this process too, of like how successful the game is or isn't, like, is not the determiner of if we did the thing that we were supposed to do. And I think having to remind ourselves, like, at every point, like, we're in this because our job is to pour our lives out for people. you know, like we need to model what Christ has done for us. And so I think in that regard, we very much feel like it's a ministry, you know, like we get to minister to people by pouring ourselves out, by making ourselves vulnerable. And no matter what the outcome, you know, like that, that can carry forth, like our testimony can help people, you know, and like it can be healing to people even in our devastation, you know.
We have gone so much over the time I told you we were going to
spend. Sorry about that.
No. I have loved this conversation so much. I just think the world of both of you, and I'm just so in love with your creation. It's so beautiful. It's such good art. Thank you both so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It means a lot to me.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,